Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009.
Now I'd like to introduce Harry Brandt Chandler is a fifth-generation Californian. He now devotes most of his attention to photography and civic work after a long and varied business career spanning 30 years, working in every medium from film and television to newspapers and the internet. His photographs have been shown at the California Museum in Sacramento and will be the focus of an upcoming show in September at the Autry National Center of the American West in Los Angeles. Dr. Kevin Starr is the State Librarian Emeritus of California and a professor of history at USC. Starr has written 10 books, six of which are part of his Americans and the California Dream series. His new book, Golden Dreams, California in an Age of Abundance, 1950 to 1963, Americans and the California Dream, comes out next month from Oxford University Press. He's the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2006 National Humanities Medal and the Gold Medal of the Commonwealth Club of California, and the Lifetime Achievement Award from Penn USA West. It is my great pleasure to welcome Harry Brandt Chandler and Dr. Kevin Starr.
First of all, let me congratulate you on this book. And just to get right to a very important point about it, let me thank you for finally explaining to me Angeline. I now understand. Because although I've spent years in the archives trying to construe California and Los Angeles history, that particular explanation always, but to see her as a meditation on celebrity itself in an almost pure Gnostic form, what I think is just a work of genius.
Well, many people might have questioned why Angeline was in this book, but she has attained celebrity status by putting billboards up, which was certainly a dream that very few others had. So, anyway.
After all, Foster and Kleiser was invented, the billboard invented here in Los Angeles in the early 1900s. Well, I just want to say, just in general, it's a marvelous book. It's the interaction of his photographs, especially as you've recast. I don't have the proper vocabulary because I'm not a photographer, but if you recast some of these or historicize some of these photographs, and then the write-up you give of these figures, and then your own personal encounters with them, either growing up or when you were interviewing them, it makes for a wonderful quality of personal testimony in the book, as well as exposition. And so I just wanted to say that, how much I enjoyed it. And let me ask you just an obvious question. I've spent my life, working life, doing books about dreams, California and the Dream. And I was just thinking, the dream endures and finding the dream, inventing the dream. And even if I go on now to the 1960s, I've got the title, Smoking the Dream, California, California in the 60s. But you've attached it to Los Angeles figures, and with new resonance for me. How did that come about in your thinking about when you were organizing the project?
Well, the genesis of this was being reintroduced to photography. I used to shoot a lot in high school and college, and then started a career in the movie industry, and then later in the internet industry. And I about 10 years ago, I had a film company called Dream City, And I always liked the name. I thought Dream is sort of an evocative name. As you know, you've put it in the title of every one of your California history books. And I thought Dream City was sort of an evocative name about Los Angeles more than about California. So I kind of just noodled on that. And then when I started shooting photos of Los Angeles, a few friends of mine commented that your photos are sort of dreamlike. There's a quality of hyper-reality to them. And I thought, okay, so maybe there's a tie-in here. Still not just shooting for myself. And then finally got a little more serious, started taking pictures of landscapes and events and a few people, and then threw them on the lap of my editor, Patty Calistra, who's here from Angel City. And she said, well, I like the photos, but I think we got to narrow the focus, and let's just do dreamers. And
well, to me, it made sense, but it also reminded me that your grandfather, Harry Chandler, Harry Chandler, had as one of his columnists, Carr. Is it Harry Carr? Henry Carr wrote Harry Carr, Los Angeles City of Dreams, 1933, if I remember correctly, which was I think one of the first books to announce Los Angeles as a brand new, not a brand new since it went back to the 18th century, but as a brand new American metropolis. And it's a wonderful book. Do you know that?
I do. And that was an inspirational, along with other things,
wonderful.
To sort of create the Dream City brand.
And then you broke them, so you have this cast of characters, and it'd be very interesting to see the ones that didn't make it through, because the ones that did are wonderful. Then you went through the process of categorization. I think that's a crucial point in any kind of organization of any book, is when the design of it, the selection, the architecture of it comes to you.
Well, when you first think about, all right, what are dreamers? What makes a dreamer versus a successful lawyer, a successful artist, how does someone kind of move to the next level? And is that something that is obvious, or in some cases it's not? And so I sort of thought quite a bit, talked to a lot of friends, helped me think about who I should put in this book. And eventually I narrowed it down to 54, and there are 8 chapters, and sort of the organization, we're going to walk through one from each chapter tonight, so you get a sense of who's in there. And the other thing I did, which you'll notice, is once I realized I wanted to go back in time rather than just take my own photos, to me, L.A. is a city of color, and it's bright color, it's hue, it's high chroma. So when I went back in time, I started licensing photographs of a Howard Hughes or a Helen Hunt Jackson, and then coloring them in, putting new backgrounds on them, and really sort of making them modern in a way that you've never seen these people. So we're only going to show you 8 photos tonight, but you'll see 1 or 2, I think, that have been manipulated. And I made no bones about trying to be journalistic. I really wanted to create drama rather than just accuracy. So,
well, your categories, just to do them, say them at one time all together, the builders, the inventors, the artists, the folk heroes, the activists, the entertainers, the entrepreneurs, the discoverers. Very, very interesting categories. Now, the builders, you have Abbot Kenny of Venice, and has a wonderful portrait of Abbot Kennedy, and Frank Gehry, of course, and Dr. Robert Schuller. That's very interesting. You have a total of 3 clergy, to include Amy Semple McPherson in the book, and of course your grandmother Dorothy Buffum Chandler, Mrs. C. Simon Rodia, the Watts, and I didn't know that Simon Rodia left Los Angeles later on in his life, and there was a kind of sad quality to him, not really fully enjoying the celebrityness that would come to him eventually, and. Mia Lehrer and William Mulholland, of course, the great civil engineer.
So in each chapter, I tried to find people both well-known and always, you know, very accomplished, someone who, in every case, had done something more than just the norm, what was expected. What I found again and again is almost all these people moved to Los Angeles, Southern California, brought expectations that were very different than what they found here, and because of the weather, because of our lack of history, because of our sort of tolerance for anything goes, they were able to create things and projects and experiences here that they wouldn't have in Boston or Philadelphia or the Midwest where they came from.
Well, you bring that point out beautifully, that the city was almost a tabula rasa that had to be filled in. It was a semi-empty space in which the dreams then actualized into social reality. Well, I don't think we should be too concerned with conflict of interest, because I would like in this category, to talk about your grandmother, Dorothy Buffum Chandler, because I think she's equal to any of these, and the fact that she's your grandmother gives you an added insight. There's some wonderful biographical details of what it was like as a youngster growing up with such a formidable lady as your grandmother.
Well, I assume most of you have heard her name. She's the one that put the Music Center on the map here and also rescued the Hollywood Bowl in a time of need. So there's a good example of a photo that you've never seen before, and had to choose her dress color and her hat color. She was a bit like a queen. She was very regal. She was not your sit-on-your-knee kind of grandmother. Growing up, we saw her mostly once a year. She would have the most formal of dinners for Christmas Eve in Hancock Park, finger bowls, which, you know, I wasn't quite a kid that grew up with finger bowls, but she had a lovely quality to her. And after college, I happened to move back and was the only grandkid that was living nearby. Her husband had just died, so I became her escort to the Music Center almost weekly. And it was really in those period that I got to know her, and I share some sort of interesting stories about that.
Well, you're also very frank about the fact that this identity she had to struggle for, and that it cost her a period of depression. She had to go in for analysis, et cetera, to find out exactly who she was and what her role in life would be. So this persona you encountered was earned and enabled her to be such a formidable figure. When she passed, Joan Didion wrote her obituary, well, one of the many obituaries. And the one that I was very moved by was Joan Didion. And Joan Didion said that there are certain kinds of women, and she mentioned Phoebe Apperson Hearst and the University of California, Mrs. Leland Stanford and Stanford University, and Eleanor McClatchy and the McClatchy newspapers, and your mother as women who left the place, the city, the enterprise, the university, in quantum leap of improvement because of their involvement. In my new book, I try and pay tribute to your grandmother in terms of the emergence of Los Angeles as a super city and the welding together through the music project of the various elements in the city. And I think all your portraits of Mulholland too. I was very touched by the tragedy of Mulholland towards the end when the St. Francis Dam collapsed, but you show him so resplendent in the height of his power, and you quoted that beautiful speech he made, which it was new to me, about the water, when the water came down there. Next time I drive by there at Sylmar, I'll think of that. And then the inventors, you know, you'll have to forgive me, but I went to a Jesuit high school, so I have to do a Latin root. The word invention comes from invenere in Latin, which means both to make something up, but also to come upon that which is already there. And so many great inventions are, and you quote one of the inventors saying that seeing it again for the first time in a fresh way. Of the inventors, who would you like to discuss, or would you like to maybe make a run on some of them and zero in on one or
can we have the next slide? Well, it wasn't working in our test, so thank you. All right. Some of these you'll know. Dick Rattan is the man that piloted the Voyager airplane around, first circumnavigation. Fascinating man, lives up at Edwards Air Force Base up in the desert, and he's kind of a tough old military guy who just takes no prisoners.
Very distinguished Vietnam-era pilot, yes.
George Barris is sort of the king of the hot rods and invented the Batmobile and many other great things. He still works out in the valley customizing, pimping your ride, as they would say today.
You have a beautiful phrase that Detroit gave him the empty palette, the routine car, and then he took it and then made an art form out of it. It's very...
Hobie Alter is someone that I was fortunate to know. Hobie invented the fiberglass surfboard and the Hobie Cat. He's a Laguna resident, and we bought our first surfboards from Hobie and our first catamaran, and he's still a great legend in the outdoor world. We're going to talk about Donald Douglas. Let's see if this works. There he is. Donald was a very bright guy who came out here looking to sort of find a business, wasn't sure quite what to do. Aviation was brand new. And he was really the first one who saw Southern California as a place for aviation. And he did his first plane, ran out of money, didn't work. He got introduced to my great-grandfather, Harry, who raised a little money through, you know, called up his 11 friends, said, finance this guy. They took over a movie studio in Santa Monica and started building planes, the Douglas Aircraft Company.
I was fascinated to learn from your description that he got his degree in aeronautics from MIT. So MIT was teaching aeronautics at a rather early, not too long after the invention and heavier than.
Yeah, you wonder what they were really studying in those days. I mean,
probably spent a lot of time on Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah. Fairly simplistic, I would think. So,
well, and of course, that even as we talk right now, many people are aloft in a DC-3, which, all things considered, it has to be, whether the DC-3 or the Dakota military transport during World War II, has to be one of the most successful, if not the greatest, most successful of all freight and passenger bearing planes in aeronautical history. And I was fascinated with that because I linked it later to, and we'll come to that later, to George Ellery Hale and the rise of Caltech as a center of aeronautical engineering, and then the Jet Propulsion Lab, which links up a kind of part of the DNA code of Los Angeles, if you will, attached to all the wonderful gifts coming from this aeronautical impulse that Donald Douglas represents so well.
One of the things I learned in researching him, which was he was just turning over the company to his son when the jet engine was invented. And his son sort of hesitated for a while before moving into jets. So McDonnell Douglas was really the premier. McDouglas was really the premier. They were 80% of passengers were flying in Douglas aircraft. And his son didn't quite see the jets coming. Boeing came in. They were first to market with the jet engine, jet plane. And that was really the shift. So another thing you learn is the challenge of passing on that sort of sense of invention to the.
So the DC-8 came too late then, or
By the time they brought their jet out, it was like 2 years after Boeing had, and a lot of the airlines had already ordered their Boeing fleet, and so it was really the turning point.
Well, I thought it was very appropriate reading your write-up that Douglas went into a bicycle shop because earlier when the Wright brothers did their invention, some people observed that they combined the bicycle and the kite to solve the question of heavier-than-air aircraft. Well, I love following the technology of aeronautics with art, with the transforming power of the imagination. And you have a wonderful cast of characters here. Could you just review some of them for me? I think this is the first time I've seen Rudy Guynrich in such illustrious company, but after reading your write-up, I think he belongs there. He's certainly a figure in, shall we say, the eroticization of fashion.
Well, he's remembered for that, but when you actually researched him, here's a guy that led the fashion industry in that sort of vibrant take-no-prisoner 60s. So he invented structureless bras, he invented see-through things, but he also invented all these sort of more formal things, evening wear, but they were always done with sort of that op color and very bold sense of style. And, you know, West Coast had never had a designer who really, you know, it was all Paris at that time and a little bit New York. So here is this guy working out of West LA who really set standards in the early 60s. And we know him from his monokini, as the topless bathing suit was called. But That was really one of very many things that when you research him. I put some very diverse people in this group too. Ed Ruscha, probably our best known contemporary artist, fascinating man. I've been a collector of his, and it was great fun to meet him. Nobu, I'm sure we've all.
Can I go back to Ed Ruscha? The linkage that you make with and through you quote him that for him to come into Los Angeles and see the neon signs, the lettering, the whole vibrant colors of lettering that you mentioned earlier this evening. That explained to me why.
There's a lot of great artists out there. Why I chose Ed was he and LA, I think, are inextricably linked. He saw this sort of vernacular. He was a traditional artist when he moved out here from, I think, Kansas City. And he kind of fell in love with the signs. He became a commercial artist sort of on the side. And then he finally said, I'm ready to take the plunge and become a fine artist. And we know him from his Hollywood signs, his Standard Oil, his Lacmon Fire. He really has sort of taken all the iconographic LA images and made them into art. And in doing that, he was one of their first of the sort of pop artists, but he's gone on to, you know, sort of stay in that kind of way for the last two or three decades. And
well, if you find time in the future, I think you could do a separate book on him.
He's great.
You understand.
He's the only American artist ever chosen, I think, twice for the Biennale. I mean, really solid but inventive guy.
And of course, Jim Morrison has a great generational icon, avatar, whatever word you want to. I mean, he really was, and dying at 27 of a heart attack in Paris. Very tragic.
Well, you know.
You going to his concert as a youngster from your New England prep school, going down to New York and going in there and.
I was fortunate to see him at the Fillmore East just after he'd been arrested for obscenity in Miami. Jim was, you know, a poet as well. He cared as much about his poetry, and he actually retreated after two or three of the hit albums into sort of a drug-induced poetry writing phase where, you know, everyone was like, Jim, you got to get out and make the next album. So he was an artist. He wasn't just a kind of rock and roll guy.
Well, when you think of how many of those figures we lost much too soon, there was an occupational hazard in being in advanced music at that time, wasn't there? I mean, Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix, et cetera, and Mama Cass, et cetera. I mean, we just lost too many really talented people whose life cycle would have continued and creativity continued on. And then, of course, Raymond Chandler. You have a beautiful photograph of Raymond Chandler.
Well, Raymond has become synonymous with Southern California. I mean, he's created this sort of noir, the dark side. When we think of kind of late night LA, we have to think of Raymond Chandler. And what I loved about him is he was a banker, an accountant. He was doing all these things that he kind of hated. He had moved here and he moved 14 times when he was in Southern California. I mean, he was always searching. And he finally happened to say, maybe I can be a writer. And, you know, we all love his literature.
Who would you pick out for?
So we're gonna talk about one who most of you won't know. His name is Gaijin Fujita, and he shows at LACME. He shows at some of the big galleries in town. What I liked about Gaijin is he's Japanese American, grew up in East LA, had a very very modest little house that his mother still lives in, and he was sort of more influenced by tagging gangs than art school. And finally, people said, you got to go to art school. And so they sent him over to a magnet school over in Fairfax. And every day he used to take this bus back and forth from East LA to Fairfax. And he'd look out at sort of the tags and he'd start to get ideas. So he finally did go to a formal art school. But he was still sort of unsure of what he would do with his life. And then at his parents' urging, his father was not famous, but a fine artist as well, said, you got to go to Japan. You got to go see the homeland, which he had never visited. So he goes to Japan tours, and he sees the famous Golden Temple. And he's just struck. I mean, here, you can't really get close to this thing. It's just solid gold on the outside. So And he had this sort of devious idea from being this kid from East LA. What if I spray painted on that? And you just, when he tells me this, you're like, really? You would think of this? So he comes back and he changes his whole style. And he puts gold leaf on the canvas. He and his tagging team spray it. And then he starts painting these really sort of Hokusai Hiroshige-like cranes. So his art, this is, he's standing in front of a early mural he did. But the art that he sells now for tens of thousands of dollars is about combining East LA with traditional Japanese imagery and then sort of LA words and images, palm trees. So it's a great blend of the immigrant experience. And I thought Gaijin would be a great example.
And it's also a way of recognizing the unfortunate direction that many talented artists, potential artists, take in becoming graffiti artists. And in this case,
he got out of that.
Out of it.
Yeah.
And you suggest that there could have been a real disaster that he stayed in that world because the temptations to gang life and gang banging, et cetera. I was fascinated by that. And also the influence of you bring out Japanese woodblock painting and the heavy lines of classical Japanese illustrations, and how much that dovetailed with his abilities. And the spray paint can being appropriate. Hey. Beautiful discussion. Now, folk heroes, of course, there's Arnold Schwarzenegger, my former boss, who was a delight to work for, and Amy Semple McPherson, who leaves her Echo Temple here just a few blocks away, and Huell Hauser, whom I know very well, and incidentally, Huell Hauser dedicates a portion of the earnings from his TV program to various philanthropies, to include a program that he has with the State Library for service to the blind and disadvantaged, etc. And Charles Hatfield, whom you'll have to tell me more about, and of course Angeline, and I don't want to go, but I've done enough discussion of Angeline and express my gratitude to you for explaining her to me. I felt in the presence of a kind of Jungian archetype that I finally understood.
Well, she was also the most notable to actually photograph. She shows up in her pink Corvette in Hancock Park, where I'd put up a backdrop. Wouldn't get out until the money had exchanged hands. She was the only one who requested a fee. And then the most strange thing happened. She got in front of the psych that I'd set up. I took one photo of her, and she jumped out of her pose, came over to the camera and said, "Is that it?" And I said, "No, we're going to do some more." And she says, "Well, you only get one picture." And I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "No, you can only take one picture of me." And I said, and she says, "Well, I'll let you take another one, but you have to delete the first one first." And I said, "Really? I've never heard of a model wanting one picture of a in a session." She says, "No, that's the way I work." And I was like, "Well, okay." So I deleted that one. Eventually, I convinced her with another $100 to let me keep three pictures. So, of course, I had to use all three in the book.
But would you think she and Charles Hatfield would get along?
So let's talk about Charles. This is a guy most of you probably haven't heard of. He was known as the Rainmaker. Many of you maybe remember the Burt Lancaster film that was based on this life. So he came here in the dry turn of the century with this idea to create rain. And he studied it, and he created this formula that he had invented this big word for. And, you know, like a lot of people before mass media, you could convince some people. So he got two or three farmers to kick in a few bucks. He put this pan about 12 feet across, about 12 feet up on the ground, evaporation. And he predicted within 2 days when the rain came, and it hadn't rained in 2 months. So the farmers talked about it, and Charles was very smart. He also hooked up with a PR person. So they were running ads in all the local papers of his successes. So eventually the LA City Council heard about this, and they said, "Gee, we're really in a drought. They're closing churches early because people have to help in their fields because there's just no water." So they, first and only time, paid someone to create rain. And sure enough, Charlie Hatfield went out. He and his brother built two or three, one up in the valley, one over here. And sure enough, a week later, they had rain. So then the end of the story, or this is much abbreviated, was San Diego. San Diego heard about this. Well, they had even less water than L.A. So they said, look, we'll pay you, I think it was $5,000, a very big amount, if you can fill our Otay Reservoir, and which had been, you know, like in our drought today, way below the level. So he announces that he will take this commission, builds, again, these evaporators with the secret stuff, and again, within a week or two, it starts to rain, and it rained, and it rained. It flooded San Diego. And so much that the city council reneged, because now they were facing hundreds of thousands of dollars in flood damage. And the suit went all the way up, I think, to California's Supreme Court, which eventually ruled in the city's favor that he couldn't prove that he caused that rain, and so he wasn't able to get that. But great character.
Well, the activist categories, you've got a wonderful group of people, some names very familiar, like, to me anyway, like Charles Lummis and Upton Sinclair and Helen Hunt Jackson, and our current mayor, Villagarosa, and other names not so familiar. On the other hand, you've chosen to discuss a very classic, I think if you sort of looked at the total arc of influence of Southern California's emergence of identity, she played a major role, and that's Helen Hunt Jackson in the novel Ramona.
I think most of us have heard of Ramona, but I became a bit of a minor scholar in it as I went to the house where the book was supposed to have been set out in San Joaquin. I went to the play. I went, you know. So what you find is in the 1880s, the Spanish heritage of Southern California had been ignored. The missions were crumbling. The Californianos, or the early settlers, were not much discussed. It was really an Anglo kind of, we're building a new city, we don't want to look backwards. Same time, the American Indians that were living here, the tribes, were in really serious poverty. They were being pushed off their lands left and right. So here's Helen Hunt Jackson. She's a New England writer of some note, and she reads this thing about the plight of the American Indians out in California. And so she gets on a train, she comes out here, and she actually partners with Abbot Kenny. And they go and they visit the Mission Indian tribes, and she writes this book that she is convinced is going to change Congress.
Centuries of Dishonor.
Centuries of Dishonor.
For which she's incidentally appointed a federal commissioner, one of the first women to hold that position in American history.
So this book, she hand delivers with a very sort of dramatic way to each member of Congress. Nothing happens. So she's very distraught, and she thinks, well, what if I were to write about the Indians in a way that Harriet Beecher Stowe had written about the American blacks, i.e. Uncle Tom's Cabin. Here's a fictional book that became a bestseller that people who never cared about slavery that much suddenly got very focused about this. So that's what she did. She set out to write this book. She came out, parked herself in Los Angeles, where she was living most of the time, and started researching, met some of the early California families, the Coronels.
Coronels, yes.
Coronels.
Antonio Coronel. Yeah.
And saw some of the early haciendas. So she comes out with this book, and what I didn't realize until I had researched this was the impact this book had, not just in the few years later. Southern Pacific built a whole railway stop just to visit the hacienda that the book might have been set in. All the tours for the next two or three decades were all about Ramona. She was the single largest sort of booster.
But it sparked a revival of Spanish architecture.
Right. The irony was the romantic setting that she set for the book kind of overwhelmed the plight that she was trying to discuss. So
yes.
The book had a huge impact in sort of romanticizing our Spanish past, very little impact in helping the Mission Indians.
Well, you discussed the play, too, when you visit the play, and I always remember that two of my favorite actors got their start in the Mission play, Victor Jory, one generation, and then later Raquel Welch got their start playing as Ramona.
So the I put her in the setting. This was not a photograph that. This is actually the house that inspired her, they say, and it's a great. It's still open to the public. It's a great visit.
She was a very good friend of Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. They're from the same, as you bring out, from the same Amherst background. Now, the entertainers, that's something that most of us would feel that would be a very easy category to come up with. And
it was actually the hardest.
Oh, it was. Oh.
If you think about, I worked 20 years in the entertainment industry. If you think about every actor, every director, they're all dreamers. They're all trying to do something different. They're all trying to sit on this world stage and accomplish something unique. So it was very hard to sort of say, okay, well, how do I pick one actor, not another, one director, not another? And I know many actors and directors and producers, so it was a difficult decision. And in some cases, I sort of opted for the generic, for the acting category. I just thought it would be unfair, so I went to an acting class and took photos of some up-and-coming actors rather than picking one. I think most of you know, maybe not all. Greg McGilvery is maybe the one you don't know. He's the one non-Hollywood. Greg does the IMAX films. He's a Laguna Beach. He really invented the widescreen epic. And he's had cameras on the top of Everest and underwater. And if you've ever seen an IMAX film, chances are Greg McGilvery directed it.
Well, and you, of course, have a wonderful portrait of Billy Wilder, whom I was delighted to see portrayed, because behind him comes all that, or with him comes all those talented people who fled the Nazis in the 30s and 40s and came to Los Angeles and really internationalized the city. I know there's a famous anecdote of Otto Preminger in 1944 playing cards at the Hillcrest Country Club, and the people he's playing cards with started to talk Hungarian. He stopped the game. He said, "Wait a minute." He says, we fled Europe. Europe is in chaos. We fled here. We found freedom here in Los Angeles, safety, ability to practice our craft, our art, free from oppression. And you're sitting here talking Hungarian." He said, "This is Los Angeles," he said. "Speak German."
One of the reasons Wilder was so successful, I chose him because he was a writer, director, even did a little performing. He was really a triple threat. And he arrived here with some notable credits, but they were all in German. He fled the war, couldn't get into America, couldn't get a visa. So he came in through Mexico. The first border crossing agent refused to let him in because he had almost no English and he just looked like a ragamuffin. The second one said, "Well, what do you do?" And he'd learned just enough to understand. He said, "I'm a director." And then the guy goes, "We'll make good movies."
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful story, because tragically, the great sociologist Walter Benjamin was turned back trying to get into Spain by a similar guard and went into despair and committed suicide. I mean, this story has a happy ending.
He was also, you know, being a dreamer can be a you know, if your grandmother says, "Oh, he's just a dreamer," that's actually not a compliment, right?
Yes. I like your portrait of how he listened to the radio and picked up 25 new English words a day when he
He was really hardworking, and it didn't come easily, and particularly when you're writing. It's one thing to be Erich von Stroheim or one of the German directors, but when you're writing Some Like It Hot, you better know English and you better know English comedy. So
yes. That's a wonderful portrait. It reminds me of the fact that also that Freddie Kollner arrived here in 1940 not knowing a word of English, and a few short years later he wrote about his teenage daughter, Gidget, filled with all sorts of teenage slang, etc.
Yeah.
Now, the entrepreneurs, now there's, of course, a great category, and you have a broad sweep here of the. Would you want to review some of the figures you have? You have well-known and not so well-known.
Well, one of the things that started me on the sort of lifelong quest, I guess, to understand more about California history was my great-grandfather, Harry. I never met him. He died in 1944. And upon his death, he asked his family to burn all his letters and all the private correspondence. And here was a man who was as responsible as anyone in the first 40 years of the 20th century for sort of helping to invent Los Angeles. I mean, he was on 50 boards of directors. He had more land than any other individual. He ran the LA Times from about 9 p.m. to midnight every night. You could go visit him at 1 in the morning. He would take office hours at 1 in the morning till the paper went to bed. Tireless worker, wasn't a drinker, just worked. And he had, you know, his hands in everything from the Hollywood Hills, the Hollywood sign, aviation industry, Memorial Coliseum, Caltech, et cetera, et cetera. And he burned it all. So I've been trying to sort of reconstruct what he was like by reading others. And
that's
a few stories in here that I've uncovered.
That is so sad to hear. I mean, that's a tremendous loss to history, the loss of those papers. Incidentally, the great California-born philosopher Josiah Royce, who taught at Harvard for so many years, wrote a tremendous autobiography, and his wife burned it after his death. So there was another document. Well,
let me tell the one story about Harry that I used in the book. So I'd heard this anecdote about he and William Randolph Hearst, and never quite sure if it was true or not. And at the Huntington, I found actually the handwritten correspondent of someone who was on this trip with him. So, in fact, it's a legitimate source. So, as the Great Depression hit, William Randolph was in the middle of his great building campaign up at Hearst Castle and all of his 10 other mansions. And suddenly, the paper revenue declined. Sound familiar? He couldn't make payroll. So he goes to an L.A. bank, one turns him down, another one comes. Well, Harry was on the board of one of the banks, and he heard that WR, as they called him, was looking for a loan. So he called up the bank president and said, all right, we're going to give him the loan. I'm going to personally guarantee it, but you can't tell him I'm doing it. And it was pledged against the land and Hearst Castle. So two or three years later, Harry got a call that William Randolph was late in making payments, and that the bank had disclosed the consequences, that Harry Chandler could take over much of that land. So William Randolph invites my great-grandfather up there with this other man. And Harry had never been up there. And so he showed up thinking that he was just kind of looking over the property to see if he wanted it. He had some thought, maybe some of the cattle that he was running on another one of his ranches, the Tejon, he might graze over there for the summer or something. Well, anyway, he's met by William Randolph at Hearst Castle, and Marion Davis are there to just host him. And these are two of the great newspaper rivals. I mean, you know, one owned the Examiner, one owned the LA Times, and they were, this wasn't just a sort of calm rivalry. In those days, there were verbal attacks, you know, almost daily in these papers. So William Randolph didn't quite know what to expect, and they make nice, they give a tour, and then he finally says, so why did you guarantee this loan? And what are you going to do about it? And Harry Chandler looks him straight in the eye and says, well, if I ever heard that you were tottering on the edge of destruction, I wanted to be the one to push you over. And William Randolph sort of, you know, beat, and then Harry breaks a smile and says, look, I just wanted to help a fellow newspaperman, and don't worry, we'll...
Oh, my goodness.
So anyway, funny story.
Funny story. Well, the last category, the discoverers.
We're going to talk about someone here.
You're going to talk?
I want to talk about, Seth, who do we have up here?
Some more of the entrepreneurs?
Yeah, we've got one of the entrepreneurs here before we go on.
Please.
He's the least known of the people in the books, and I thought I'd talk about him because, again, he's sort of representational of what LA and Southern California, what it means to be in a dream city. So this is a man named Edgar Acosta.
Oh, the restaurateur.
Right. And I heard about him through friends at Farmers Market, the original one on Fairfax. So his backstory is the following. He's grows up in the Philippines, working in the restaurant industry, dirt poor, he's kitchen help. He finally works his way up to be running a service at a hotel in the Philippines. A sheik comes in from Kuwait and hears about this guy who's running this nice restaurant and says, will you follow me back to Kuwait? I've built a new hotel there, and I need someone to run the restaurants. And Edgar says, I'll you know, I've got my family here, I've got this. And the guy goes, well, look, I'll pay you to come back once every year and you can see your family. But the amount of money was so much more than he was making, he sort of said, okay, I'll take this. So he's now running a restaurant in Kuwait, not very happy living there, as you might imagine. Suddenly, they get word that all hands on deck. In comes Norman Schwarzenegger. Desert Storm is centered at this hotel, all the American military. So he now is told, whatever you do, you take care of the general. So he becomes Schwarzenegger's number one sort of cook and what do you need kind of guy. Desert Storm comes, Desert Storm ends, and suddenly the restaurant's going to return to normal, and Schwarzenegger says to him, you've been so great. Is there anything I can do for you? We've got troop planes going back to the U.S. I can get you a visa. What would you like? And Edgar says, well, I would love to reunite with my family, and I'd love to move to the U.S., but I don't know anything about it. And Schwarzenegger says, just pick a city, and we'll fly you there. And he said, Hollywood. And, you know, he obviously had grown up seeing movies, and that's all he knew. One word, Hollywood. So he comes here. He starts at a Shakey's Pizza. So here's a guy who's been running a whole food service, starts at Shakey's Pizza. Next thing he's know, he's working at this creperie, and the boss of the creperie has to sell it to expand something else, and pulls his friends from Philippines together, gets enough money. He starts with the creperie. He's now got another one at Hollywood and Highland. He's reunited with his family. Just a great...
Great story.
Immigrant dream story. So.
Wonderful story. And the last category, then, the discoverers, you have, of course, the great, almost hard to talk about, he has such influence of Walt Disney and the great science fiction writer Ray Bradbury and Aldous Huxley, and noted novelist and maybe the godfather, if you will, the sort of psychedelic age in so many ways.
Well, there's a good story. So he writes Brave New World when he's in England, which is really his seminal sort of thoughtful novel. He comes to California sort of in search of something different. And this is in the late 50s. And he starts, you know, reading up on counterculture. He eventually writes Doors of Perception and really kind of takes his writing and his thinking and his lifestyles to very different places. He moves out to the Mojave Desert. He's experimenting with LSD when no one else has heard of it. And his final, actually, the day he dies is the day JFK is assassinated, and then he's pleading with his wife to give him one last injection to remove the pain. Great, great story.
Well, and talk about your grandfather's, great-grandfather's papers not being with us. Huxley's papers were burned in the fire at Bel Air fire. What was that, about 61, 62, and his
house, yeah.
His house was gone. Who do you pick to sort of zero in for us tonight in this great group?
We're going to talk about George Ellery Hale. Let's see if his photo will come up. There he is. Oops. Hit it twice. Can we go back? So here's a guy, well-to-do, living in the East Coast in the early, I think, turn of the century. And his father was fortunate to have a small fortune and bought him his own sort of mini telescope observatory. And that's Andrew Carnegie on the left and George Ellery Hale on the right. So George is convinced that the study of astronomy is going to be about telescopes and how do we build bigger ones. And so he comes out, tours the whole country, looking for clean air and a population that can build it, and chooses Mount Wilson. Kind of hard to believe that this was clean air, the best we could do. But so what was remarkable about him is he was both a scientist and he was just a dedicated fundraiser. I mean, he built the three largest telescopes ever exist. His last one was a 200-inch. It was the largest thing that a foundry had ever created. It was built in, the lens was built in Corning. When across the country, crowds would gathered to watch it on the train station. They hauled it up by hand with wagons and mules. And I read even as recent as last year, new optics and new computers have made that clearer than the Hubble telescope. So, I mean, just an amazing, and this was in 1940s that he put that up. So, dedication to astronomy. All the great astronomers that we've heard of, Hubble included, used his scopes to, you know, map the cosmos.
And he was one of the triumvirate of executives that ran Caltech and brought it up to its current preeminence. Well, we have some time now, Harry, for, incidentally, one thing I wanted to say is to compliment your publisher, Angel City Press, on the physical appearance of the book, the layout, the design. It's a very, I love book arts, and it's a beautiful book, very satisfying book. And we have time to, if there's questions, if anybody would like to bring any questions up to Mr. Chandler and have him discuss about the book, any points of view, and just, please, sir.
The picture of Dorothy Chandler, it's a convertible. I expected to read Thunderbird, but instead it says Weekend. Why is that?
Well, I was fortunate to grow up in a car family, so my father was one of the largest car collectors in the city, and he had all these contacts. I emailed everyone and said, what is a weekender? You know, who made the weekender? Because I wanted to indicate this. Because it says weekender, and I thought, was there a car called the weekender? So all my friends couldn't find it. No one could, you know, obviously if you search on Google for car weekender, you're going to get, you know, 10 million things. So sure enough, we go to press, the book's out, and someone gives me a book called Cars and the Stars. And there's Brigitte Bardot in France in a Simca Weekender. So who knew? Hi. Well, there were 100 people I left out. We sort of designed how big the book was, and Frank was certainly one of the people who had an enormous impact as an actor, as a songwriter, as a singer. So maybe in book 2 I'll put Frank in.
Please.
Just really a comment. I had the privilege of going many times to the Ramona pageant. And the attendance is really down so this past year. So if anybody, it's a great thing to do. And if anybody wants to make an effort and go out there and see it, it's well worth it.
I'm sorry, I missed the start. What was
that? The Ramona pageant.
Ramona pageant.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had this impact that we just can't appreciate. I mean, imagine Harry Potter times 50. I mean, it was everyone in the city had read Ramona. Everyone in the country was coming to Southern California to see the real Ramona, to see what it was like, to touch this sort of romantic Spanish past. And it lasted for 3 or 4 decades. I mean, just enormous impact.
Well, yeah. One, please, sir.
Since you're a native Californian, I wonder, because I've taken trips, I was a native of California, and I've taken trips to the East Coast, and I'm always struck by how strange the East Coast seems. And I wonder if you had that impression, especially when you were younger and going to prep school, if you thought that the culture there was so incredibly foreign from what you're used to.
Well, I left California at 14 to go to New England. And this was right, you know, late 60s, where they were all convinced California was the craziest, weirdest place. And I had never experienced a culture that was as set in their ways and like, we've done it this way for 3 centuries and why would you want to do it? And I was ridiculed just by being a Californian. And I, you know, cut to 1995 when my daughter went, I prepared her for this. I said, oh, you're going to be ridiculed. Well, she wasn't. It's changed. But, I mean, one of the things I think we all like about Southern California and this dream city is we can do what we want. There is really almost no limit, as long as it's legal, to inventing, protesting, writing, whereas Boston and Philadelphia and, You know, the, even today, you do half of the things that these dreamers did in those cities, and you won't either be successful or you won't create the attention. So, yeah, at 14, I saw it firsthand, and, you know, I put my Doris poster on my wall and, you know, declared that California was the best. And
Governor Schwarzenegger gave the commencement at USC this semester at the end of in May, and he said if he hadn't come to Los Angeles, he'd still be back in Austria yodeling.
But one of the things I learned about our governor is, of all the people in this book, he was the most intent on his dreams. He was a teenager in Austria who literally wrote down his life goals, and they included become world famous, move to California, marry Kennedy. He said this as a teenager. Pretty amazing. And
adding 1,000.
He certainly is. And Ronald Reagan accomplished a lot, but Arnold was very intent, and he became obviously world famous bodybuilder, world famous movie star, and now our governor. So.
Well, I think our audience can get a flavor from your commentary about how lively this book is, and it's a beautiful combination of photography, explication, historical background, and then your personal encounters. I really make for a wonderful book. And again, I'll make that comparison again. Harry Carr, City of Dreams, 1933, and we'll put this up right in my collection at home. I'll put this right next to the Harry Carr book.
Well, thank you, Kevin, for someone who knows more about dreams in California than anyone. I appreciate your coming here.
Learned a lot from the book, and I thank you for coming with us this evening.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.